You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll learn about a Wisconsin cheese company that calls itself a string cheese pioneer. First, the Marquette University Law School released their latest poll today asking registered voters in Wisconsin about topics ranging from President Trump to the state budget to who voters trust in government. Charles Franklin joins us now. He's professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start out. This poll has a different political makeup than previous polls. How is it different?
There's been a little bit of a bounce in a Republican direction by about 2 points or so. In this poll, Democrats and Republicans are equally sized, 45% each. Over the last 3 years of all of our polling, that balance has been about 43 for Republicans and about 48 for Democrats. Now, the difference there is inside the margin of error, which is 4.5 points. So this is not necessarily a meaningful change, but it does raise the possibility that after voting for Donald Trump last year, the state could be edging a little bit in a Republican direction. However, the March poll didn't show that shift, so I'm raising the point for people to be aware of it in this particular sample, but we'll also look at it long term to see if the state is changing its political makeup in any meaningful way. But to really know that that's happening, we'll need several more polls all showing this same kind of movement before we're confident that there's a real shift taking place.
Well, that'll certainly be interesting to follow. Healthcare, obviously, been a big issue in the news lately. And when asked what they would like to see Congress do about the Affordable Care Act, 6% favor keeping it as it is, 54% would keep it and improve it, and 27% favor repeal and replace, with 7% wanting repeal and not replacing the law. What do you make of those numbers, especially the 54% that want to keep it but improve it?
This has been a fairly stable distribution of opinion throughout 2016 when we were asking this question, and it's virtually unchanged from our March poll till now, despite the House passing its bill and the Senate just beginning to do theirs as we were in the field. I think what we see is small percentages, 6% for keeping it just as it is, 7% for getting rid of it completely. And then you see in this middle, keep and improve with twice the support as repeal and replace. It means the public is not that thrilled with radical change either direction. But on balance, improving what we have is more attractive than replacing it with something new.
Which is interesting because the mantra in Congress among Republicans is repeal and replace, repeal and replace. Does Wisconsin stand out as different than other states in how they view this?
I think we're not very different. When we see national polls that ask this same kind of question, we get very similar answers to it. What is important both nationally but especially here is that there's a massive partisan difference in opinion. 71% of Republicans, nearly 3 in 4, favor either repeal and replace or completely repeal. So that's a reason for Republicans in the state to listen to their voters and see them calling for some form of repeal. Democrats are just the opposite. There we have an even more massive 91% that want to either keep it or keep it and improve it. And when we look at independents, a big majority, 67%, want to keep Obamacare or improve it. Only 29% want some form of repeal or replace. And so there's this big partisan difference that gives Republicans an incentive to listen to their voters. And after all, they've campaigned on repeal of some kind for nearly 7 years now. But a big split in public opinion on it, and a lot of skepticism about what the replacement might do.
You asked people where they believe the power was in Congress, who was able to make things happen or stop things from happening. And what kind of response did you get when you asked about their knowledge of controlling Congress?
This is one of the questions that Donald Trump has talked a fair bit about lately, saying that it's Democrats who are blocking him from accomplishing things, that they're delaying or obstructing. And actually, a plurality of the public goes along with that. 43% said that Democrats were blocking his efforts. 39% said it was different factions within the Republican Party that was preventing things from going on. So a fairly even balance, but a little more Democrats. And we did have 5% that volunteered on their own without us saying it, that Donald Trump himself was the source of his problems.
And I'm guessing that of that 43% who said that Democratic opposition is preventing President Trump, that was probably not evenly split between Democrats and Republicans.
You know, you just can't ask a question today without finding very large partisan differences. The only question is whether Republicans are going to be in the 60s, 70s, or 80s on one side, and the Democrats 60s, 70s, or 80s on the other side. We do see a little variation on how big the gap is, depending on what the policy or person that we're asking about, but partisan divides are rampant through our data these days, even more so than they were 3 or 4 or 5 years ago.
We're talking with Charles Franklin. He's professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, and he's director of the Marquette Law School poll, which released its most recent findings today. Charles, let's move to the state level. You asked respondents about their top priorities for increases in state spending, and what did they say they were willing to pay their taxes towards?
Here we are in the middle of the budget making in the legislature, and it's been 4 months that they've been debating it. So we asked first, what's your top priority for additional spending? 37% picked K-12 education, 25% health care, 23% roads. Everything else, local government, prisons, and the UW system were all in low single digits. But willingness to pay for your top priority, 61% said that they were willing to pay more if it would go to their top priority, 35% not willing. But there's a big difference. Those with K-12 as their top priority, 75% would pay more. Healthcare, 59% would pay more. But when we get to roads, 46% would pay more, but 51% would not, even though they said roads was their top priority.
Well, maybe it's no surprise that transportation budget is such a sticking point right now up in the Capitol. Finally,
absolutely.
Finally, you asked respondents about their trust in government, and people said they trust their state government more than the national government. Did that surprise you at all?
We have seen this before, but it's interesting to see it here in Wisconsin, where we have had our share of party polarization at the state level as well. But at the federal level, a full 76% said they could trust the federal government only some of the time or never. That drops 24 points to 52 who say that about the state. But when we ask about your city or town government, only 34% say they can't trust the city or town. Excuse me. So it's clear that the more local the question, the closer to the voter, the more trusting they are, with the federal government having lost 3 out of 4 voters on this trust issue. But more of an even split for the state and a substantial 64% who say they can trust their local government.
And Charles, as we wrap up, I know I'm curious, and I'm guessing our listeners are too. How do you and the other part of the Marquette Law School poll team decide what to ask? Of course, there are some kind of obvious things like, you know, rating popularity of different leaders. But how do you decide on the other questions?
Well, some of the things are core. We ask approval rating and those sorts of things. During an election, obviously, we ask about the vote. But a lot is driven by what are the current issues. So we're asking about health care right now because it's a pretty prominent issue on the national scene. We're asking about the budget right now because the legislature is not only debating it but seems stuck on it. And we were asking specifically on that transportation question because we've been asking for over 4 years about what to do with the transportation budget, and the public over that whole time, no matter how you ask the question, and we've asked it in a variety of different ways, seems really conflicted between their desire for good roads, but at the same time a real reluctance to accept any of the things that would be necessary to pay for that. And I think that's an important dilemma for government, and it's important to see that the public also participates in that dilemma, just as our political leaders participate in it by not quite knowing how to solve this issue.
Well, Charles, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. He joined us to look at the latest law school poll results, which were released today. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Bicycling in Wisconsin in the 1890s was called the most independent, healthful, rapid, and convenient mode of travel. As part of our ongoing look at objects from Wisconsin's past, Tom Rademacher tells us about the Kenosha-made Sterling Safety Bicycle.
Cycling in the 1890s was predominantly a male activity. However, this bicycle allowed women to also engage in the recreational sport of cycling. The Sterling Safety Bicycle, it was manufactured in 1899 by the American Bicycle Company. It has a lowered top tube, which accommodated the fashionable dresses of the time for women so that women could also go on rides. Bicycles entered into the United States in 1869 on the East Coast from Europe and then pretty much just steadily moved westward. And by 1880, there was a national association for bicycling called the League of American Wheelmen, which was founded on the East Coast. But Wisconsin had a Wisconsin State Division, and then there were about 40 local club divisions within Wisconsin. Wisconsin, at its peak, was ranked 8th in membership and one of the leading divisions of the West. The wheelmen, the bicyclists of the 1890s called themselves wheelmen, so the wheelmen of the 1890s created promotional materials like handbooks, maps, and things like that, which enabled cyclists of that era to link up with other clubs in the area, find the best roads for cycling and avoid the worst ones, because most roads in the 1890s were just mud and dirt trails unless you were in a large city like Milwaukee. And so it was oftentimes difficult to actually enjoy the sport on the poor roads. And they would publish pamphlets and materials trying to promote the need for better roads. But they also tried to get people like farmers on board and advocated for farmers, trying to get them to understand that a better road will help get their produce to market.
Where there's a wheel, there's a way. But with bicycles, the way has been rather tortuous. There were no traffic signals in those rollicking days.
Interestingly, the company actually switched from manufacturing bicycles to then automobiles at the turn of the century once the bicycle boom ended. And this is just a reflection of how quickly the decline of bicycling happened and shows the start of the rise of automobiles as being a premier mode of transportation. I'm a big fan of cycling, and I wanted to learn more about the history of biking in Wisconsin. The part that interests me the most about the safety bike and the movement is the interesting connections that can be seen in the 1890s as well as to today, because a lot of the materials that the wheelmen published in the 1890s are things like maps and route materials and listings of bike shops and hotels for people to travel to. And that's the same kind of material that organizations will put out today for their members. It's over a century ago, but yet we can still do the same kinds of things today.
That story was produced in partnership with Wisconsin 101, a collaborative effort to share Wisconsin's story and objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
And now we're turning our attention to one of the biggest snack foods today, string cheese. Baker Cheese in St. Cloud, Wisconsin, isn't the inventor of string cheese, but they consider themselves string cheese innovators, or string cheese pioneers, if you will. Dan Higgins is here to tell us more. He writes about food and drink for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So what exactly does it mean to be a string cheese pioneer?
Inventor is always kind of tricky when it comes to food and history, but Francis Baker, who was the son of Frank Baker, who originally founded Baker Cheese back in 1916, went to a seminar about mozzarella cheese, which is what they were really big into making at the time, and it kind of got the wheels turning in his head about the stretchiness of the cheese, which is why it's so popular in pizza. You know, when you pull a piece of pizza away, it's got mozzarella, it's got that nice stringy texture to it. And it kind of got him to thinking about just the nature of mozzarella. And so he took, in the story that, you know, Brian Baker will tell, who's currently the president and Francis' grandson, he took a block of their, they were doing consumer-sized blocks of mozzarella cheese for sale at typical homes and retail locations. And he took it, heated it up, stretched it out, rolled it, cut it up into pieces, and then just kind of started taking out and testing it to see how people would react to it. You know, that's where you get that stringiness from when you pull it apart. So that's kind of where it started, and they just kind of kept going with it and figuring out how can we then go from having to hand roll and hand stretch the cheese to creating, basically building machines that will then do that for us as well. And from there, just kind of kept growing.
And so when were they first starting to experiment with the string cheese?
That was the late 70s.
Okay.
1970s is kind of when that all started to happen. And the timing was actually pretty good because that's, back then, you know, shredded cheeses were still, you know, that wasn't really a thing. You know, there weren't a lot of shredded cheeses in the grocery stores, and that was about to come. At the time, they were playing around with this string cheese, and what started, you know, was a couple hundred pounds a month, and has grown to be about 3 million sticks, up to 3 million sticks a day that they're turning out now.
Featured in lunch boxes nationwide, I'm sure. So I am curious because, as you said, the mozzarella on pizzas has that really nice, you know, elasticity. And obviously the string cheese has that stringiness to it. But like when you get fresh mozzarella, it doesn't have that quality at all. So what do they do to the mozzarella to get it into that shape and that condition?
And that's where that reheating actually is what does that. You know, so you get the cheese where normally if you're going to make your mozzarella, you'd go through the normal process. You separate the whey, you turn into curds, you then compress the curds together to form it into blocks and cut it up and package it or shred it or whatever. Well, what they do is instead of just letting it age or and actually mozzarella is not aged at all, it's a fresh cheese, but what they do then is they take it and they actually reheat it in water baths. And it's in that second reheating then, and then the rolling and the stretching and the machines that they use now to get it to that size, that's where that stringiness really comes into play for them.
So I've seen other cheeses like Colby Jack and stuff that are kind of calling themselves string cheese because they look like it, but it's really not string cheese unless it's that mozzarella, right?
You can always come up with names whatever you want, but I mean ultimately it is, you know, to me the test is if I pull that and I get that nice fun little pieces of strings coming off when I rip off a piece, to me that's string cheese, and that's how I would define it. And yes, it's the mozzarella, just that stretchiness that lends it to be that kind of a cheese.
And I have to say, it just doesn't taste quite the same if you're just biting into it, if you're not peeling off those strings.
Right, exactly. And this is one, too, where actually you should let the string cheese warm up a little bit or even pop in the microwave for a couple seconds if it's coming out of your refrigerator, unwrap it. Don't do it in a single wrap. But, and pull it then, you're going to get more. That's where, and if it's really fresh, it will actually squeak as well, just like our cheese curds.
Like those curds. So is Baker Cheese still a family business?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. They're in there right now. Brian Baker is the president and CEO. He's fourth generation. And then two of his brothers and one of her cousins are also in lead roles with the company right now.
And so they have taken on the mantle of being string cheese innovators, string cheese pioneers. That's a lot to live up to. What's next for Baker Cheese? What do they see on the horizon?
I think continuing to kind of experiment, and you'll see this now where they've got a jalapeno string cheese out, which has little pieces of jalapeno in it, or, looking at what kind of add-ins can you now add to the string cheese, so it's not just the regular string cheese, but what are some of the other flavors you can add in to kind of expand that. I think that's one as far as the innovation side of it goes. I think it's just continuing to produce lots of string cheese as the demand, demand continues to go. The snack cheeses are really a popular item right now. For snacking, it's not just necessarily in kids' lunches anymore. It tends to be, have a nice little piece of cheese with a good amount of protein to snack on. It's easy to transport, especially those individual wrappers. It makes it super easy to just have it on hand if you just need a little snack to get you boost to get you through the afternoon kind of lulls.
Convenient and delicious. What more could we ask for? Dan, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Dan Higgins. He writes about food and drink for USA Today Network Wisconsin, and you can find his article about Baker Cheese on the Central Time Facebook page. Congressional debates and negotiations about health care could change provision of services and access to coverage for many people, including those covered by federal programs like Medicare and Medicaid. In the past, those programs were considered untouchable, but not anymore. There's often confusion about what those programs cover and how people qualify for them. Donna Rosato is a senior editor at Consumer Reports. She specializes in writing about personal finance and money issues, particularly healthcare costs. Donna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
How many people are currently covered by Medicaid?
There are so many people covered by Medicaid. One in five Americans are on Medicaid, more than 70 million people. And this is a government program for low-income Americans to provide them a way to get health insurance.
And how much does the federal government spend on Medicaid every year?
It's a big-ticket item, $545 billion a year.
The title of your Consumer Reports article is Who's on Medicaid Might Surprise You. So what are the misconceptions about who is on the program?
Well, I think a lot of people kind of have an image, a preconceived notion in a way, that people on Medicaid are not working, they're lazy, they could get a job, but they're not. Perhaps they don't take good care of their health. So they don't get the proper care. And then when they do need care, they use the insurance on Medicaid. It can really drive up costs. And so it's an image that people have that is just simply not true.
And so what do people have to do in order to qualify to get coverage under Medicaid?
Well, a couple of things. Generally, it is based on your income. And it's a certain multiple of whatever the federal poverty level is, and it changes, by state. But it's always been for folks who are at or near the poverty line. Now, what happened a couple of years ago when the Affordable Care Act, also known as the Obamacare, was rolled out in 2014, the federal government offered money to states that expanded their Medicaid program to a higher income level of folks. you know, not people making a lot of money, but still above that poverty line. And so what that did is that in many states that chose to expand Medicaid were able to put more people on their Medicaid rolls because of that. And, you know, so it expanded, I would say, you know, so you had a slightly higher income group of people who are on it.
So those people, yeah. I'm guessing, were not switching to Medicaid from other health care coverage. They probably didn't have health care coverage and then were able to access that through Medicaid.
That's exactly right. You know, most people do want to have health insurance, but have no way to afford it, even if they're working. Even if you're on the ACA today, I mean, health insurance is not cheap. I think if you have employer health insurance, you know your costs have been going up. And that is true of people on the ACA. But if you're on Medicaid, many of those costs are covered. And it is exactly what you said. Most of the people who got aid through the expansion wanted insurance and couldn't afford it, or they didn't know they could qualify. Because in states that did expand, they did a much better job of outreach and letting folks know that, hey, you may be able to qualify. We're going to help you figure out how to do that.
You zero in on several individuals' stories to illustrate the groups of people who are on Medicaid. Let's start with having you tell us about 96-year-old Grace Miller.
Grace Miller, she's a widow of a World War II veteran, and she is probably one of the type of people you may not think of who is on Medicaid. There are a lot of elderly people who depend on Medicaid, and many people who come from middle-class backgrounds. And what people on Medicaid who are elderly depend on is for long-term care. I think one of the misperceptions that we have about government health insurance program is that Medicare, which is the health insurance program for people 65 and older, mm-hmm. does not cover long-term care. And that is the kind of services that you need either for a nursing home or, you know, ongoing care, and it can be at home or in a community-based service, but anything you need long-term is not covered by Medicare. And what happens to folks like Grace Miller, who lives in South Carolina? She had been funding her own tab for assisted living, which was several thousand dollars a month.
Mm-hmm.
But then she has very severe arthritis and just got to a point about 2 years ago where she really couldn't walk or care for herself. She needed to be in a nursing home. But that care cost $6,000 a month. She did move into a nursing home, but then she quickly ran through her personal savings. But once someone does run through their savings, you reach a threshold, generally $2,000 left in assets, then that's where Medicaid kicks in. And what that meant for Grace and other elderly people is she could stay in the nursing home, which she couldn't pay for herself anymore, but Medicaid would pay for and get the care she needed. She didn't have a lot more options if that did not happen. And I would just me give you one statistic that 64% of nursing home residents are covered by Medicaid.
Hmm. You say that about a quarter of people on Medicaid are the elderly, which is a large proportion, but even larger, nearly half of Medicaid recipients are children, and many of them have special needs. Can you give us an example of what Medicaid provides for those children?
Yes. I think a good example is a young girl named Amber Todaro, and she's 12 now, but 2 years ago, she started having very severe abdominal problems. And at first, they didn't know what it was, but after a couple of weeks, as it became more and more painful and critical, she had a colonoscopy, and she was diagnosed with very severe Crohn's disease, which is an intestinal bowel disease. And it was very severe for her. She couldn't eat. She had to be put on a feeding tube. She was put on medications that cost medication infusions that just, you know, sticker price were $25,000 each.
Mm.
Now, the Todaros have health insurance for their family through Amber's dad, but it simply doesn't cover everything. And for Amber, one of the things that Medicaid covered that her dad's insurance didn't cover was for a nurse to come into their home and administer those medication infusions, which could take hours. So instead of having to go to the hospital and sit there for 6 hours, which it could take to do this every 3 weeks, she was able to have this done at home. There were some medical specialists that would not have been covered by their family insurance that she was able to have covered.
Donna Rosato is a senior editor at Consumer Reports, specializing in writing about personal finance and money issues, especially as related to health care costs. And we're talking about Medicaid and who is on the program and what possible changes might mean for those people who have that coverage. So the third group on Medicaid are adults with disabilities. And how many people are covered for that type of care?
Well, the numbers are that 6 in 10 people on Medicaid are working adults. And so that gets at one of the stereotypes that people who are on Medicaid don't have jobs. And, but most of people, majority of people on Medicaid, have a full-time job, or I think it's 78% of households that have someone on Medicaid have someone working at least part-time. But what that means is one of the reasons that people are on Medicaid is not just because they have low income, but one of the reasons they may have low income is because they have a disease, a disability, a chronic health condition that doesn't enable them to work either full-time or they might cycle in and out of the workforce. I spoke with a woman named Elizabeth Nicolosi who lives in New Orleans, and she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis back in 2008. Today she's 42. She has a degree in computer information technology, but as her disease has progressed, which was right around the time she was diagnosed when she got her degree, it's been really difficult for her to work as her symptoms have gotten worse. So she's done administrative work. She most recently has been working as a waitress. And she has relapsing MS, and she takes a lot of medication, but when it flares up, she's extremely fatigued, her hands shake, her muscles ache, she gets dizzy, and she's literally unable to work for months at a time. When Medicaid was expanded, she was able to get Medicaid insurance on Medicaid that not only enabled her to have health insurance, but to get the medication she needs to that she could afford to treat her disease. And she said to me, if it weren't for Medicaid, I would have been in a wheelchair by now. And also, being on Medicaid allowed her to have the medications that enabled her to work. Now, she does cycle in and out of the workforce, but because of the medication, she can continue to work. Before that, before she was on Medicaid, she would just sometimes go without seeing doctors or getting the medication she needed because she just couldn't afford health insurance.
So, Donna, as we said earlier, 70 million people are currently on Medicaid. Of course, the health care plans that are in Congress are not final, but what are the estimates of how many people might lose that coverage if the health care plans being proposed right now are approved?
Well, the funding, there are two things that would happen with with the Senate bill, which is proposed to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. And it would do two things. It would get rid of the federal funding to states who have expanded their Medicaid program to include more people who have a higher income. And the federal government, Medicaid is a state and federal partnership. It is administered by the state, and it does have funding to the state, but the federal government funds this, and the federal government has funded all the expansion. And that would eliminate the expansion that all the people who had gained health care through the 23 million people who had gained health care through Medicaid would lose it. But it would also greatly change the Medicaid program. And it would cap the amount of funding that people on that states would get from Medicaid. And the amount they would get would increase very slowly, much slower than it is increases currently under the current program. So the estimates are that funding for Medicaid within 10 years would be cut in half between what the Senate is proposing as well as proposed budget cuts by the Trump administration. And of the 23 million people who have been projected to lose health care insurance if the Senate bill becomes passed, is approved, 15 million people on Medicaid will lose health insurance in 10 years.
Those people who would lose coverage under Medicaid if the program was changed, they would still need care. How would the slack be picked up if they are no longer on Medicaid?
When Medicaid funding is capped, there would still be funds available. They're not getting rid of the program, but it would be upon the states to make some pretty hard decisions. One of the things states could do is dip into their budget and take money from other areas right now, you know, maybe infrastructure or spending, and add it to make up for the funds that they may no longer be getting from the federal government. That's a pretty tough choice. Some states have asked to impose limits on eligibility, for example, only allowing someone to be on Medicaid for 5 years, and after that, you'd be off. So a lot of this would fall to the states to make some difficult decisions. I mean, at the end of the day, people want their residents to be covered, but when you only have so much money to go around, you have to figure out some way to deliver services that people can use. Another thing states may do is just limit the amount of services or the kind of services they provide.
Donna, thank you so much for joining us today.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for talking with me about this very important issue.
Donna Rosato is a senior editor at Consumer Reports. You can find a link to her article, Who's on Medicaid Might Surprise You, over on the Central Time Facebook page.